Or we talked about the law of supply. Sometimes you hear the phrase the law of supply and demand, but there's actually two laws. And we talked just about the law of supply during the first hour, and that law is stated right on your syllabus. The quantity supplied varies directly with the price. The quantity supplied varies directly with the price. This line, which we never know the exact shape of when we're talking about any product or any service of any sort, we never know the exact shape of this line. All this line illustrates is this direct variation between quantity supplied and price. Let me put a P up here and a Q here. QS, I'll make it. Quantity supplied and price. And this line on the graph shows that correlation, that direct correlation between the quantity supplied and the price. As the price increases, the quantity supplied tends to increase. As the price decreases, the quantity supplied tends to decrease. And all of this occurs because of self-interest, people acting in their perceived self-interest. That's the reason why you can come up with a principle or a law like this. People, producers, who see the prices rising, produce more to take advantage of the rising prices. They respond to that. If you are an employee and someone offers you an increase in wages, an increase in your salary, on the condition that you work an extra 5 hours or 10 hours a week, and if the increase is large enough, you will probably take it. Now you have to weigh considerations, other considerations against this. Is this extra money worth the time away from my hobby or my family or whatever it might be? So there are many other considerations besides money. But as people, as employers bid up wages, they can induce workers to spend more time working. The quantity of work supplied in that case varies directly with the wages offered. Wages are prices. They're not something different from prices. Well, in this hour, we need to talk about the other law, the one we haven't mentioned yet, and that's the law of demand. And that's stated right at the top of the next page of your syllabus. It's the last page during the second hour. And the law is simply that the quantity demanded, not the quantity supplied, but the quantity demanded varies inversely with the price. Now we have to look at things from a consumer's point of view, not from a producer's point of view. The consumers demand things. The producers produce things. They supply things. And looking at it from the consumer's point of view, the quantity demanded varies inversely with the price. If the price rises, the quantity demanded will tend to fall. If the price falls, the quantity demanded will tend to rise. So if the price of gasoline doubles from $1 a gallon to $2 a gallon, the demand for gasoline will tend to fall. If the price rises, the demand will tend to fall. If the price falls, if the price of gasoline goes from $1 a gallon down to 50 cents a gallon, the demand for gasoline will tend to rise. The quantity demanded will tend to rise. As the price changes, demand changes in the opposite direction. The quantity demanded changes in the opposite direction of the price movement. It varies inversely with the movement of prices. And again, this is something that doesn't just apply to what we call business or finance or narrowly economics, but to all of human action, all of human decisions. How do we get this out of any of the things we've talked about so far, this idea of the law of demand? Well, again, it comes from the idea that we're pursuing our self-interest. If the price rises, we don't buy as much. Society as a whole perhaps consumes less. You have to add always the qualifying language, other things being equal. Other factors can change too. that would not make that the case. Now let me ask you a couple of questions. And these are things that if you don't think of during this hour, you'll probably think of after you leave and wish you would ask about. So I'm going to raise them right now. What about such things as jeans? You can buy jeans for $75 a pair. Or basketball shoes. Spend $150 on athletic shoes. Now, they seem to flow in the opposite direction. What makes them attractive to many young people, the jeans or the athletic shoes, is their high price. They want to buy those items, the ones with the name tags on, you know, the designer jeans and the designer shoes or whatever. They want to buy those items precisely because they cost so much. Shell out $100 or $200 a pair for athletic shoes, when you could go over to Sears or Penney's and buy them for $20 or $30. Why spend $200? Why do people go and spend $200 for such items if there is such a thing as the law of demand? Why does that high price attract demand? Why does it increase demand? I'm sorry? Okay. What is their interest, though? What are they buying? They're buying prestige. They're buying status. They're not buying athletic shoes. They could get a pair of athletic shoes for much less money, but what they want is the athletic shoes with the label on that shows they're in the in crowd. The same thing applies to many other things. In fact, you'll see ads at times for various items in the newspaper, in the magazines, saying this item is expensive. Well, why would any businessman advertise that his item, his product, is expensive? Because he's really selling something else. He's not just selling a coat or a pair of jeans or athletic shoes. He's selling status. He's selling respect. He's selling esteem. He's selling prestige. That's what is being sold here. Not just a piece of apparel, not just footwear. So those items don't contradict the law of demand at all. It's precisely the high price in that case that indicates the prestige. That is an indicator of the prestige. It says to the person, to your peers, to your friends, to your acquaintances, wow, that guy has money, or that guy is cool, or whatever it might be. And that's precisely the effect the consumer is buying. That's why I added the phrase, other things being equal. We're no longer selling just athletic shoes. Other things are not equal now. You have something else there that is being marketed. Can anybody think of any other examples of things that seem to contradict the law of demand, the idea that the quantity demand varies inversely with the price, that as the price falls, the quantity demanded will increase because people acting out of their self-interest will tend to desire more, or as the price rises, people will tend to buy less? Can you think of anything else that might appear to contradict that? Well, think of it. Consider it. Maybe you'll come up with an idea later. Let's look at, some of you objected perhaps to, or weren't convinced is a better word, way of putting it, I guess, that perhaps people don't always act in their self-interest. And one of the things that I mentioned was missionary, who might take a dramatic cut in pay because of what they're doing. But even a missionary, or even a person engaged in charitable work in the U.S., when they receive a donation and they have to spend it on supplies or whatever it is they're going to buy for their work, do they say, well, I'm not going to act in my self-interest here, or do they look for a bargain? Do they look for the lowest price they can get on things? Of course they do. They're acting in their own interest there. They're not going to squander their money. They're going to look for a bargain. They're going to look for the lowest price they can get on things. And they all do this. Now, you say, well, they don't get, perhaps, maybe I'm trying to anticipate your objections, they don't get, perhaps, the very lowest price they could get. But they look for the lowest price for the kind of item they want. They may want something of good quality, something that is not made out of tar paper or whatever. They could get an item that's put together poorly, perhaps for less, but it's only going to last half as long. So they'll pay a little more to get something of better quality. That's again why I added the phrase, other things being equal. Because those items are not equal. They're getting something of better quality by paying a little more. But they're going to look for the best bargain they can, and they're going to have to decide in their own minds which is that best bargain. And they will always decide that with a view toward taking that action which benefits them most. Even those engaged in charitable work. Now, if we were to illustrate the law of demand, as we have illustrated the law of supply here, with a line on the graph, how would we draw it? That is, the quantity demanded varies inversely with the price. How's it drawn? Downward to the right, okay? Keep in mind again that this is just an illustration. Now, let's look at it. This means that at $10 here, we'll draw it over to this law of demand here. We have 14 units demanded at this price. At $25, oh, wrong one. Yep, sorry about that. Took it over there too far. Need to go to this one. At $25, demand falls to about 6 units. And this is an illustration of this variation, this inverse variation between quantity demanded and price. Now, what do you suppose this is? What is it where those curves intersect? The balance between the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied. This is the point, the price at which the quantity supplied equals quantity demanded. And it just so happens on this one that it's going to be a little bit more than $20, it looks like. And the quantity is going to be about 8. Those numbers don't mean anything. They're just there for illustration. But this is this point here, this intersection, is the point at which there's a balance between supply and demand, the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded. What's that point called? Anybody know? This point is called the market price. That point is called the market price. That is the point at which every willing buyer finds a willing seller, in which the supply of an item, whatever it might be, is equal to the quantity demanded. Every willing buyer finds a willing seller. Every willing seller finds a willing buyer. And that's called the market price, where the two curves intersect. This is, again, keep in mind, these laws, these two laws of supply and demand, result from people pursuing their self-interest as far as in the marketplace. And what you end up with is a price. Now, in the marketplace, this price continually changes. Continually changes because circumstances are continually changing. People's wants are continually changing. What people desire, what they choose to buy, their plans are continually changing. The weather, any circumstance you can think of might affect this quantity supplied and quantity demanded, so the prices are continually changing in the market. So you'll sometimes you don't notice these things very often. If you're a homemaker and you go to the grocery store, you notice them. The prices at the grocery store are continually changing. They may fall within a certain range at certain times of the year, but they vary from 1 week to the next. 1 week, especially where we lived in New Mexico, 1 week milk would be $2 a gallon, the next week it'll be $3 a gallon. It'll move 50% in 1 week. The price of eggs will vary, the price of produce, the price of meat, cereal, anything you can think of. In a market situation, those prices are continually changing because the suppliers and the consumers, the producers and consumers, are continually responding to the market. What's being demanded? What's available? And this is normal. There's nothing unusual about this. This is normal. But the prices vary. Some people get upset by that, especially people who believe in just prices. They think that the price should always be the same. But the prices continually change. Circumstances continually change. That's a fact of life. Fact of life. And no government, and we'll get into this in a little bit, no government can prevent it. No government can prevent that from happening. We are talking about here principles of human behavior. Principles, the way people think, the way they plan, the way they make choices, that they themselves cannot change. Certainly no government is going to change them. And these laws, let me label these curves here. This is the supply curve, and this is the demand curve. These laws are the result of those principles. People making choices and making those choices and decisions in their self-interest. Now, are there any questions so far? Yes, sir.
Just for clarification, when we look at the price, we're looking at the price as saying it's going up based upon what a supplier can get and what the consumer is willing to pay.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Those are the two determinants of the price going up. And then so he decides to produce this much quantity based upon that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Obviously, there's other perspectives that you're going to probably.
Well, there's more implications here, many more. But I want to make sure this is clear before we go further. Yes, sir.
Does demand happen before supply?
It makes no difference. In fact, I would argue that the supply happens, if you want to use that word, before demand. But in any case, they work in the market simultaneously. People are, we're all, as I said, we're all consumers and we're all producers simultaneously. In fact, what we produce, whatever we produce, if we work, it's our labor services. If we manufacture something, it's those things that we manufacture. Whatever we produce are how we demand things in the marketplace. We're trading, we're exchanging. And it is precisely our production that becomes our demand. That is how we trade and exchange things. Our work that we produce is how we demand and get a wage. It's how we demand and buy things in the marketplace, the product of our labor. So they're just looked at from two different points of view, as it were. But you can distinguish between production and consumption. But no one consumes without producing anything. Now you say, well, what about people on welfare, people getting checks from the government? Well, still, the laws of supply and demand apply to welfare programs. If you raise welfare benefits, that is, you're rewarding unemployment or idleness or whatever it might be, by raising benefits, you're going to get a greater supply of welfare recipients. One of the colloquial way of putting this, if you pay more for something, you're going to get more of it. So if the government runs a welfare program and it raises benefits, you can expect to see welfare recipients the number of welfare recipients go up. If they cut welfare benefits, you can expect to see the number of welfare recipients go down. If you pay more for something, you can expect to get more of it. Same thing with unemployment compensation. If the government raises unemployment compensation, you can expect to see more unemployment. People find this ironic, but one of the causes of unemployment in the U.S. is unemployment compensation. If you pay for something, you can expect to get more of it. And if the government pays people who are unemployed, they can expect to get more unemployed people. These principles apply to government action as well as all private action. On the other hand, if they cut welfare or unemployment benefits, then you can expect to see the number of people on welfare or unemployment decrease. If you pay less for them, you will get less. Yes, sir?
How is this put together when you go to buy roses on Valentine's Day? Was the price all of a sudden went from $25 to $80?
Okay. Good question. How does this apply to buying roses on Valentine's Day? Well, obviously, you have a tremendous demand for roses on Valentine's Day. But you also have rose growers, florists, anticipating that demand. So they will plant or whatever they do to grow roses ahead of time so that they can be assured of getting an ample supply to meet the demand, the heavy demand on Valentine's Day. Nevertheless, they haven't succeeded in attaining the ability of growing enough roses so that the price doesn't change on Valentine's Day. Demand still drives up the price of roses on Valentine's Day, despite the increased supply of roses on Valentine's Day. It far outstrips that supply.
So this like an invisible hand idea that puts price or
It's because the florist anticipates getting $80 a dozen that he's willing to pay $60. See, now the way it happens is the reverse of what people normally think. It's the retail price and the judgment of the retail florist that drives up the prices at the wholesale level. He says, well, last year I sold all the roses I could get for $80 a dozen on Valentine's Day. This year I'm going to buy more. And last year I paid maybe $55 a dozen. This year I'm going to go as high as $60. So he will bid up the prices for roses from the wholesaler. And the wholesaler will in turn bid up the prices from the rose farmer, the rose grower. In this whole chain. And it's not the other way around that the rose farmer does it. It's the idea that the demand at the consumer level bids up those prices, and then as you work back to the rose grower, back the line of production to the rose grower, that increased demand bids up those prices. Now, well, he has to do his calculations very carefully if he were to take that position. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that a rose wholesaler could have a monopoly. I don't know if it's a realistic assumption or not. I doubt it. But let's assume he could. Now, he's going to then have to calculate whether he could make more money, say, by selling roses at $150 a dozen and selling fewer dozens, or whether he's going to make more money selling them for $60 a dozen and selling a lot more dozens of roses. The same laws apply here. He's going to sell fewer roses at $150 a dozen and he's going to have to do the arithmetic. Now, let's assume I sell 100 dozen at $150 a dozen, $15,000. But if I charge $60 a dozen, I'll sell 500 dozen. That's $30,000, twice as much money. He makes more money by selling at a lower price. And he's going to have to do the arithmetic there to figure out how to maximize his return. People sometimes have the idea that those who charge the highest prices have the highest income, and that's not true. There's another factor involved, and that's the quantity produced. You have to keep that in mind. And he may be more profitable selling at a lower price rather than at a higher price and selling fewer roses. Any other questions? Yes, sir, in the back.
Walmart.
Yes, you wish you had one. Where? You have a virtual Walmart, huh? Yes.
The designers have been kind of something that is only on the bubble for a while. A few years ago, or a year and a half ago, Nike was on a whirlwind prospecting team, and now they're in a downfall because nobody wants those designers to get anymore. There's something else they want. So they're not willing to pay even $50, probably now, let alone $150.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That as the fad passes, then a company like Nike may have to change its marketing. There are other products, though, that seem to remain, in the high price range year in and year out. One can think perhaps of mink coats. I've never worn one, but I doubt that a mink coat keeps you any warmer than a wool coat. But when people buy mink coats, they are not buying warmth. They're buying prestige. They're buying status. They're buying a garment that says, look at me, I'm rich. That's what they're buying. And it's precisely that high price that makes that statement. They want to shell out $10,000 for a coat. Yes, there is. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Now, doesn't the rose tied on Valentine's, isn't it also affected by the fact that you've got a short period of time, it's a short-term marketing type of thing? Everybody, the consumer, has this much time within a week to make their purchase. Delivery goes on a particular day and all that, and so therefore, they have the ability to control a certain amount of that, and either it's going to make or break.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. A long-term market, such as where you have the opportunity to shop, you don't like the price now, wait a couple weeks, go visit a couple more places, do this, do that, and control consumers a little bit, give consumers a little more of the advantage.
Mm-hmm. And men are willing to shell out the $80 a dozen because not to do so is greater risk to them than doing so. In many cases, it is.
What about the question?
But there are substitutes for roses. You know, and keep in mind, everything has a substitute.
Your demand. Is there ever does demand and quantity and vice versa both ways? They're going up and down the graph. What about balance? Does one force a balance of the other? Eventually, you know, one gets the better hand, there's more demand than there is quantity. The quantity catches up, for instance, there's more quantity than demand, and it keeps forcing itself to balance itself.
Yeah, this is the point at which they balance. This is the economists don't call it balance, they call it equilibrium. They use the big Latin word. This is the point of equilibrium, or the point of balance, where the quantity supplied balances the quantity demanded. And it's that price, that it's the market price, that the equilibrium price.
And you can depend on that?
You can depend on that. Now, keep in mind that this is continually changing, because quantity demanded and quantity supplied are continually changing. This is not a fixed point. It is continually changing. Yes?
Yeah.
It's very similar, yes. You've got an emergency. In both cases, on Valentine's Day and the hurricane, you've got an emergency. Yes. You know, one way to save money, of course, is to celebrate your holidays a week later. Convince your wife that Valentine's Day is February 21st, and you can buy roses for $12 a dozen. Or convince your family that Christmas is in January, and you can buy Christmas presents at a third the price after Christmas, during the after Christmas sale. Yes, Tony. Yes.
And the job forecast can't be based necessarily at all on all the prior calculated points.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can figure out the trend line, but there are any analysts that want to project into the future based on math, then that's pretty tricky business.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a thing as creating demand?
Creating demand?
Yeah,
yes. Yes, absolutely. There's such a thing as creating demand. And in fact, capitalism is sometimes regarded as immoral. John Kenneth Galbraith, the Harvard economist, published an essay 40 years ago saying that capitalism, all capitalism does, is induce us to buy things that we don't want or need through advertising. And that was one of his ethical attacks on capitalism. Demand can be created, and there's nothing novel or immoral about it. Trying to think of a recent popular musician. Oh no, let's use a novelist. Before John Grisham wrote his novels, there was no demand for John Grisham's novels. Absolutely not. When he wrote them and put them on the market, the consumers responded. There's tremendous demand. He created demand for his novel. Now he sells his novels ahead of time for $1 million a crack. But there was no demand there. The supply of John Grisham's novels preceded the demand for John Grisham's novel. And he created that demand. The same thing would apply to every painter who sells his paintings, or every musician, and even to manufacturers who come up with a new idea, a new product. There's no demand before the automobile was invented. There was no demand for automobiles. Then the inventors come up with automobiles, and everybody wants one. It's a new idea. So that demand is created. Yes, sir?
Isn't that demand created by supplying something that somebody wants, but not just through advertising? They're giving this novel there, and people see this novel and they like it. It's not just through advertising that the demand is there.
No, but the advertising is a major part of it. They wouldn't know about it unless they were advertised. And we'll perhaps touch on that, the function of advertising, at some point. But again, there are many cases in anything new like that. You might say, well, there's a constant demand for various types of food, and that's true. But people are now genetically engineering flowers. They're genetically engineering tomatoes. They're genetically engineering many things. There was no demand 10 years ago for these things, but now when the products are coming out, people are saying, well, that's a good idea. Those tomatoes are really good, or those flowers are really pretty, and I'm going to buy those things. So they see the product first, and they demand it. It's not the other way around. Yes, sir?
How does that compare with the old marketing maxim of when you find a need and then fill it? And say you have a community that's overrun by money. Some guy thinks in terms of, man, there's got to be a way to catch these guys to the case of a hammer all the time. So he invents a little spring-loaded device, put a piece of tea on it, snaps over and catches them out. Well, there was, in one sense, there was not any demand for that mousetrap.
Well, if people want to get rid of the mice, then you're quite correct. You found something that they want, and you've just developed a product that fits that bill, the mousetrap. But in the case of many products that come on the market, there are things that people haven't even thought of. Yes, there is. Well, we don't use the word need in this room. No, I didn't talk to you about that. But need is such a, what shall we say, such a vague term and a morally loaded term that you don't find it very useful in talking economics. For example, I'm sure that some of you parents in here have heard your youngsters say, your young youngsters say, your small children say, such things as, Mommy, I need a new doll. Or, Daddy, I need a bicycle. Well, the kids don't need those things. They want those things, but they don't need them. But why do they use the word need? If you correct them and say, no, you don't need that, but you want it. No, I need it. I need those things. Because need is a morally loaded term. It says, I want something, but you have the obligation to provide it to me. Now, it's not just small children that whine like that. Politicians do all the time. They say, we need a new bridge, or we need a new road, or we need a new program for this, or we need a new program for that. North of New York City, there's a bridge, the Tappan Zee, across the Hudson River. And the Hudson River at that point is a magnificent river. It's about 3 miles wide. It makes much of the Mississippi look like a creek at that point. And years ago, they were considering, the state of New York was considering building another bridge there because of the traffic problems. The commuters would take that bridge into New York City in the morning and back out at night as they headed to their homes up in the suburbs. And then somebody had a couple of bright ideas. Rather than whining about needing a new bridge and needing new roads, they instituted a couple of small changes. Now, it was already a toll bridge. What they did now is they varied the toll according to the time of day that you crossed the bridge. So if you crossed the bridge heading south between, say, the hours of 6 and 9 in the morning, you paid top dollar for crossing that bridge. If you cross the bridge heading north in the afternoon and evening, you paid top dollar. If you cross the bridge at other times, it was very cheap. Well, this traffic problem started to disappear just in this variation in pricing. What happens to the need here for a new bridge? You change the price a little bit and the need disappears. What kind of a need is this? Then they went a step further than this. They not only varied the prices according to what time of day you crossed the bridge, but they gave barcodes. They sold barcodes to commuters to put on their windshields so that now they don't even have to stop to pay the toll. They just drive through. And there's a little laser there at the gate that reads that barcode, notes what vehicle went through at what time of day, and mails them a bill at the end of the month. And this eliminated all the congestion at the gates. Nobody is stopping to pay the tolls, except of course for tourists who come through and don't know what's going on, and they stop at the gate and have to get out the cash and pay the money. But the need, the politicians' need for a new bridge, which would have cost the taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars, is taken care of by these two simple things: varying the price of crossing the bridge according to the time of day, and then putting a little barcode on windshields of commuters so that they don't even have to stop at the gates. They just drive through at about 25 miles an hour, and the laser reads their barcode. That's one of the reasons why we don't use need, is because not only is it morally loaded, but it is so vague a term that it's not useful. The psychology? Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Is there a special thing that you need to do in the economy? For example, create a new demand, which is the mousetrap. And so you sell a lot of mousetraps that poor guys sell their bananas.
Yeah, I suppose you could argue that. Yeah, the mousetrap becomes a substitute for the hammer. And, when the automobile was invented, everybody thought, this is horrible, the blacksmiths are going to disappear. And the blacksmiths took it on the chin for a while, until everybody using their automobiles became so wealthy that they started keeping horses themselves. And any other questions about this idea of the law of demand? That is, the quantity demanded varies inversely with the price. Yes, sir? Want. So tell your kids, next time they tell you they need $200 athletic shoes, tell them, no, you don't. You want them. And if you want them, you can earn the money to buy them. Yes? How do you
recognize demand?
You mean as a businessman?
And I want to recognize what the producer, you know, what's demanding. How do I recognize that?
Well, I don't know if I can tell you specifically, but maybe we can get into that. I've got to cut it off at this point. And save your question. Let's bring it up in the next hour. We'll take a break now.